already more interesting than your average Wednesday when Devendra Banhart stopped by my place here in Brooklyn just recently in early September, just a couple of days before he released an awesome new album called Ma. I think it's his best album in a minute. Kind of a return to form and a reminder of all of the heart and soul in his music. But I digress. It was a weird Wednesday. Why? Because it was September 11th, here in New York specifically. That just has a weird feel ever since 2001. And on this particular September 11th, we also lost the great, irreplaceable Daniel Johnston. And you'll hear Devendra remark on both of those things. But mostly in this conversation, it was great to get to talk with my dear old friend about stuff we've never gotten to before. You know, you don't always get to ask your friends such nerdy questions as I do in this convo. And, you know, Devendra's humble and tried to deflect here and there, but I tried my best to keep us focused on what I was so curious to know about, which is how this incredibly interesting and unique artist ended up sounding the way he does. It turns out some of it was the serendipity of a mistake by a used CD store. So listen for that coming up in this conversation. Also, to follow an interview with David Cross about comedy and music and more. Let's get into it. Episode 35 of LSQ.
One and a half miniature Diet Cokes in.
Yeah.
And, or actually half a Diet Coke in with the
frosty,
the auxiliary in the sidelines.
Ready.
Frosting miniature Diet Coke awaiting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're ready. You're sure where this is going. You're going to need one. You know you're going to need one. It's preemptive. It's planning.
Yeah. I have an unslakable thirst for
appreciate that
info about you, Devendra.
But you said no.
Also
but my
toxic soda.
I say so those two things. I've been described that exact
toxic
same way.
Soda.
But you just said there's an unshadable sliver of light.
There is.
I mean, that's like a bestseller. I don't know what that book's about. It could be about anything, but it sounds like one of those real. It's like a real. It's such a.
Yeah, it's a paperback mystery.
It really is. An unshadable sliver of light. A memoir. A novella. A cookbook.
A cook. Yes.
The new.
Cooking with Diet
edition,
Coke.
Edition. Cooking with Diet Coke. By L. Ron Hubbard. Written by.
By L. Ron Skewbird. So I remember the first time I ever met you, and I don't know if you remember this, but it was on Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg. Would have to have been like the early aughts.
It would have,
walking on down the street in the early aughts.
Oh yeah, when we met, I had just met Adam Green.
Mm.
To bring it back to Adam, someone who...
He unites us all.
Who is in ISIS? Is that what you said?
I said he unites us. He unites us all.
Oh, yes, yes. He's still in ISIS.
He still is.
And he's the nicest.
He loves ISIS. He also loves ISIS.
They're the nicest. Do you say that they're nicest? You think that's ever happened? Oh, you ever seen, like,
yeah, they're
Jessica,
the,
she's just the nicest.
Yeah.
And then later you're like, I can't believe it. I need to call the cops. Should they show up? Maybe they never wanted it to ever happen. Like, some of the worst things that have ever happened in history because somebody misheard somebody? That's how I get a lot of my lyrics, is mishearing.
Right.
People. I go, okay, because then I don't have to really give you credit because I misheard you. I would never, ever take a line like, an unshadable sliver of light, and not ask you permission for it. And then, and I've never actually done that, but what I'll do, it recently happened where someone said something I really liked. So I'm going to put in a song that they said this thing. So-and-so said, da-da-da-da-da. You know, so
that's,
I'm giving
you attribute,
them credit.
You give them...
Yeah, you ask permission. Can I put this line? But also I'm going to give you credit in the song.
Wow, that seems like going above and beyond.
No, I don't think so. I think that's the bare minimum. And it's always something that has irked me. And it's judgmental, and I'm judging. I'm going to do it. We're old friends, and I'm just going to be the real piece of shit that I am. And say that when people don't credit, but they don't say it's a cover, and they just play a song,
mm-hmm.
That's weird.
Yeah.
I think that's weird. And I was personally, it's an experiential, like, I guess a pet peeve, but it's like, I've experienced seeing somebody play and just going, that set was fine, but that one song, holy shit. They wrote a song that is one of my favorite songs I've ever heard. This is when I was about like 17. And then...
Pre-Shazam is your
Pre-Shazam.
Point. Yeah, Pre-Shazam.
This is when the world was black and white. And I, you know, a year went by and I'm going, this person is like basically one of the best songs I've ever heard. And a year goes by and I discover John Martin, and it was a John Martin song. Of course, it's an amazing song called May You Never by John Martin. And I was like, that's the song this person played this whole set. So I just always felt really kind of, I felt kind of gypped and I felt deceived. I felt really deceived.
Did you start by performing other people's songs? Did you learn a lot of other people's songs before you started writing your own songs?
Well, the first show, it was a wedding. First show I ever played was a wedding. And I did Love Me Tender and How Great Thou Art.
Damn.
This was what the I guess it was really the groom and the groom.
They were friends of yours.
They were my roommates, and they were friends. One of them was a Elvis impersonator, and the other one was a comedian. And he was disabled, and so his stand-up name, his showbiz name was Bob the Crippled Comic. This is already, we've been talking for like 3 minutes, you're already in number two.
Yeah, no, I'm getting there fast.
But I'm taking it personally.
No, don't. Listen, I've got a fever and the only prescription is more cowbell.
Yeah, but Bob, that was his stage name, Bob the Crippled Comic, and he would make these jokes about their German Shepherd. But yeah, they got married. They got married in a church that's still there in DuBose Triangle in San Francisco, and I played How Great Thou Art and Love Me Tender. But I had the sheet music. And after that, I try to avoid covers because I don't mind forgetting the lyrics of my own songs. But someone else's, you really want to do it justice, and I'm like so nervous about fucking up their lyrics.
Right.
And it's happened so often that I try to avoid too many covers. But I wish, I would love to just do a bunch of covers and remember them and just call them. And like.
But the wedding, you were what, like 17 or 18 or something?
Yeah.
Had you was there other forms of performance that like... you were attracted to as a younger kid? Did you enjoy putting on a
botany
show?
I just wanted to be a botanist.
Really?
I mean, that would have been my other vocation. Was like, not even that. I wasn't even that ambitious. I'd be a botanist's assistant. That actually sounds better even to this day. Where can you just, I'm going to take a specimen here, a sample of this plant. That sounds sort of cool. You're out there in the rainforest.
Listen, dare to dream that you're the full botanist.
Wow. Yeah, I see how it's not the greatest vote
of
confidence. But,
at least if you're the deputy, you're less likely to get shot.
I mean, you shot the sheriff.
The botanist, but I did not shoot the assistant botanist.
Oh, man.
You know?
I'm so sorry.
So, yeah. So that was the first time
but
you played.
Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I have lately been doing Pulp's Common People.
Oh. Fabulous.
Well, I can talk through the parts that I'm shaky on.
There's a version, Nick Cave sings a version of that song. Have you heard that version?
I haven't.
Yeah,
whoa.
Nick does a version of Common People. It's really cool. It's great.
Holy shit, I need to find that.
I think about Jarvis often and how I want to... I've never met him.
Same.
But if I do, I would like to commend him for having rhymed Whole Earth Catalog with Agog. The line is, no one ever went agog over the Whole Earth Catalog. It's just a masterpiece of a line.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. And I just want to thank him for that line so
much. Oh, my
God.
I mean, so going back, though, to the wedding.
Yeah, to the wedding.
Being talked into playing songs on the guitar at a wedding, clearly you had shown some interest to those friends in singing and strumming before that. I mean, when did holding on to a guitar feel good? Begin to feel good? When did you get your first one? What the fuck did you do with it?
I think the bad podcast guest police are I've been notified.
Yeah, like why did you have? Why were you the guy they would ask to play a song at their wedding?
The indigenous instrument of Venezuela, I grew up in Venezuela, in Caracas, Venezuela, and the indigenous instrument is called the cuatro, which just means...
A four-string guitar?
Exactly.
Yes.
The four.
Intuition.
And it's a 16-string guitar. No, it's this four-string guitar. And the way you tune it is really fun. You sing, Gambur Pinton. Which, as far as I can interpret that, it means painting banana. I don't even understand what that means. I mean, please explain what that means. I'll have to, I'm sure that I'll get many angry. Well, we'll see. But Gambur Pinton, I think it means painting banana. Anyways, the cuatro is the first instrument that I started playing as a little kid. Everyone kind of, you come across one. It's this, like, ubiquitous instrument that you play. But it wasn't until... I was a teenager that I felt really attracted to writing songs. It felt like something I could do, and I did it once when I was in the shower when I was 8 years old, and it felt like I could travel. I felt like I was traveling. I felt like, oh wow, there's only this like landscape that I can kind of travel, make up the song, and suddenly you're kind of traversing some kind of time and space within yourself. And then I'd had this experience when I was like probably 12, and I'm like, I want to sing like all these guys around me, but it doesn't feel right, and no one's home. My mom goes out, and I just put on one of her dresses and started singing as this kind of woman, and that felt really good, and so I felt really connected with that side. So singing felt good. I knew I liked to sing in a certain place within me that kind of got unlocked by putting on my mom's dress, and then writing songs felt fun and felt good, and I'd written one about plastic surgery and about like schnauzers getting plastic surgery, and the chorus was like, cause we're all gonna die. I remember that, and my family was like horrified, and they said, never ever ever do that again, please. And I thought, ooh, I got something out of them, this is fun, I'm getting a real reaction here. And I wasn't that kind of kid, you know. I was really kind of ignored for my entire childhood. Really, I really was. It was a very isolated childhood, and that felt like, whoa, this suddenly I'm like being seen. But I'm sure everybody, and I know everybody feels that. But I think mine was a particularly isolated one, and an instrument felt like the next obvious thing, right? You feel like you can sing from this particular place. You feel like songs can be written somewhere in your imagination, and then, well, I should have something to accompany that instrument, so it makes sense. And so I like begged my dad to get me a guitar. He got me an electric guitar, like the most, like the guitar that whoever's in the band in the Lost Boys is playing, like that 80s cherry red guitar, like by JP Sledgehammer.
Oh my god,
like Rocket Thunder.
Kind of Ibanez kind of
something like
situation.
That, exactly. Super rocky guitar. And I didn't, you know, it was just totally weird and mysterious to me. I didn't really like it. I had no real relationship with a guitar until Radiohead made OK Computer, and I was like, this is the coolest music in the world. Mm-hmm. I need to listen to this. This is what I know I need to like. Because I know I like it, and
right.
It's just everything. I just immediately knew the aesthetics and what they're singing about and the sounds, and this is it for me. And my father was going to London, and so I said, "You've got to get me this album called OK Computer by Radiohead. You must get it for me, please. There's used CD stores everywhere. Please, please, please. The one thing I'm asking you." He goes to London, comes back. There it is. Wow. The cover of OK Computer, it's so cool. I was trying to make art kind of like that, using a lot of like whiteout and blurring and kind of making things opaque and obscure and just like, oh, this is all everything. I opened it up and it was Way to Blue, an introduction to Nick Drake.
Oh,
so it's
wow.
Like it's a used CD store, and I remember when I worked at Aaron's Records, I probably did that a million times where I'm just like taking the CDs, checking them, and then somehow mixing it up somehow. But you just got them all lined out, you're cleaning, and then you're putting it in.
Had you seen the name Nick Drake before that?
Never.
Right.
Or I wonder how that happened, too. It might have been that also when you're buying it, you're just like, here's somebody would drop off, like, 20 CDs.
Right.
As a buyer, you're like, okay, great, great. You actually just turn it, look at, is there any scratches?
Yeah.
It might happen like that. I remember at Aaron's, I would dream of just alphabetizing CDs. You know, that just all night. You wake up and like, oh, God, I put this one, like, garbage record and the Z's, and I put the Breeders record. These are the records that were just like flooding the world at that time. Those were the last days before there was just like, you know, that was the only way you could get music. It was really through the radio or buying it.
Yeah,
it's so wild.
Yeah, the used CD market, like, that was good. That was a good.
But that's gonna be the next thing. No, for so long, cassettes. You know. Goodbye, cassettes.
Yeah.
CDs, that's the next one. The next record, I'm just doing just CD.
CD only, yeah.
Just CDs.
Wait,
so there's
the Nick Drake thing's there, and you listen to that instead.
And I just, that completely, I fall in love with playing guitar. I just want to play guitar. It's so beautiful. It blew my mind. It was everything I wanted, the sound.
The acoustic voice, guitar, yeah.
I just wanted to play that instrument. I wanted to be close to the feeling that his playing was presenting to
me.
And it's funny because I don't think anyone will ever be able to play like him.
So were you disappointed not to get OK Computer, and how long did it take you to finally get OK Computer?
Just got it the other day. It's not so bad. I got it shortly thereafter, and I loved it, and it was a really important record for everyone.
But it is of consequence, it turns out, that the error of it being a Nick Drake record turned out to be a positive error.
It certainly did. It certainly did. Thank you, whoever did that in the UK. Thank you so much. Thank you, Meth.
By the time you're playing for your friend's wedding, you had already, all of those things had already happened. You already had fallen in love with Nick Drake's music. You already had figured out, like, oh shit, that stuff's hard to play, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by that time, I was already kind of into people like John Fahey and Bert Jansch and these kinds of players, David Graham, and really getting into, like, prior to that, I wanted to be Mississippi John Hurt. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm just going to be a blues man. This is it. It's blues for me. I mean, yeah, I'm going to play the blues. And I was obsessed with Blind Willie McTell and Blind Willie Johnson and Son House and Mississippi John Hurt in particular. And Skip James and all these old blues people were just like, oh, Lytton Hopkins, totally obsessed with it. I just wanted to play the blues. And then somehow that moved into finding Nick Drake and then realizing that they were all into the same kind of blues people that I was into, and just reading about all their biographies, all the people that he was playing with, and Pentangle and Bert Jansch, like I said, David Graham, John Martin. It felt really beautiful. I felt like I finally found a community of people that weren't alive, but they all liked the same things I was really enjoying. Mm. And I got really obsessed with John Fahey because, you know, he'd written a book about Son House. And he also wrote How Bluegrass Music Destroyed My Life. And I believe Vampire Vultures is another book that I think Drag City had put out, both of those. And I just felt such kinship, and I felt so connected to this strange, mysterious community of people that are out there kind of going on these treasure hunts for music.
So where did you find that? Like, where were you?
So I'm in California at this point.
Right.
I moved to America when I'm 12 or 13, and we move up this little canyon called Encinal Canyon, and somehow, yeah, and so I asked my dad, can you get me this record? He gets Nick Drake. Then I really fall in love with Nick Drake. Oh, and then he also, he's a cool guy, and he's a really big fan of Neil Young, and he would play me Harvest. He's like, this is good music. And then one day he came home with a record called Radio Molly by Ali Farka Touré. Mm. And that also just totally blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is kind of the weird, this feels like something I'm like, have been looking for. It just feels close to that. And then because it's good, this very bluesy thing, I'm in love with all these blues people. And then there's something very kind of folksy about it. And it feels so singular. It's like really their own interpretation of the instrument. That's very attractive, that it's so unique. And then my dad, this is, I guess my dad is a huge hand. I never thought about this, but then he brought home Tropical Truth, which is a compilation that David Byrne had made for, I think, Walkabop, the early days of Walkabop. It's a compilation that has a, I think, this person kind of upside down on the cover. And it had Chico Buarque, Milton Nascimento, Os Mutantes, and particularly Caetano Veloso. That was the big one. That was the one that changed everything really for me. I heard Oleo Zeno and I was like, okay, this is everything I've ever wanted. I need to make music, play guitar, everything. Okay, great. Caetano, thank you. And
but before that, you had written some songs about the Schnauzer and the plastic surgery, but it sounds like you're saying it wasn't, you weren't really connecting the feeling good doing that to feeling good listening to music. And then like the Caetano Veloso thing is more like where you're like, wait, I could, what if I'm going to play songs, that's the kind of song I want to play.
Yeah, I think it was like, this is what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Oh, this is what I want to do.
Did you become obsessed with it once you really did start to do it?
Yeah, completely. And really scared. It seemed really scary. It was kind of like what I imagine knowing that you need to jump off of a cliff kind of feeling.
Mm.
It seemed totally absurd. I really didn't really know how to play the guitar. And the idea of speaking in public or getting up on stage seemed insane. There's no way I can do that. And I didn't think my art was any good. You're not thinking of it in terms of how it'll evolve. Not that I think it's any good still, but it wasn't like there was some significant body of work or something to present or any idea of how the music industry works or how this kind of could work as a career. I guess what it did was it made it clear that art school was going to be the thing, because I'm still in high school at this point.
Right.
And I hear Gaetano and I go, okay, this is everything I want to do. I have no idea how to do it. Doesn't seem realistic whatsoever. At the same time, I'm also painting and I really want to paint. I'm obsessed with painting and it makes a lot of sense to me too to paint. And so art school was the obvious thing. And then I dropped out to make music. I dropped out of art school to make music and start playing a million horrible shows. And eventually a cassette made its way to Michael Giroir.
Do you really, I mean, you said sort of in passing that, you know, not that you think that what you're doing now is worth anything, but so I just wanted to look at that a little bit more closely.
Well, it's not that I'm like, wow, now my work is good.
Right, you must feel differently in some ways about it now than you did when you were starting.
At the time, I didn't see art as just an ongoing practice. I just see these people that are very good at playing their instrument or at painting or at writing, and you just go, wow, there must be this moment you reach and go, now I'm very good at this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of makes sense because there is a path that you take and that you with discipline you practice and you get better and better at the thing, but there's no real, I think, destination with it. And so maybe what I'm trying to say maybe in a less self-deprecating way is that now I don't have this feeling that there's some, oh, I've understood art. It's really this endless, vast.
Right. So you're not looking at it like you've failed to get to a destination. You're looking at it like, I know that I'll never get to a specific destination. I'll just keep heading in a direction.
You just continue with your practice. But at that time, you do look at it like it must be some other, it's just another planet and another type of creature that can do this thing. And so I know this is nuts that I want to do it. It was that alien and distant, especially being a little kid in Venezuela, you know. And when you come, and it's not like you come to America and suddenly you're friends with like a bunch of managers and music industry people or something. You know, I felt just as isolated and that felt just as distant, just as far away and just as impossible. And I couldn't imagine doing it in a mainstream kind of way anyways. You know, I had to discover, I mean, that's why you find something that's considered counterculture underground and you realize that that's where it's all about. That's what it's about. I mean, I remember trying to convince my parents, like, you don't get it. No one knows my music. That's cool. I'm really happy. It's a good thing. You know, they didn't start to really get it. So there was like an article or it was in a magazine or something like that. It's kind of a sad thing to say, of course.
But well, yeah, how are they? Everything is niche to parents. But I mean, when did you, how long were you doing it before you started to feel like you had, you were like, could see it as a thing where it was your thing. And you're like, I know what this thing is, kind of.
I think, well, in high school, I had certain friends that were just sharing misery. And we all kind of like that, we were all very attracted to each other based on how much we hated high school, and that was the initial attraction. And they're like, oh, you've got some, you know, you're a little different, and I like your vibe, I like your style, and you know, what music do you listen to? And I think it was just through high school making a few friends that had a sense of some of what was kind of happening culturally in Los Angeles. And at that time, like, Modest Mouse was just starting to, they'd only put out like a 45, right. I think, that had the picture of San Francisco on the cover.
Right.
And had Figure Eight on it. And I never heard anything like that.
Yeah.
And they brought this 45 of Figure Eight. Oh, this is pretty cool. This is interesting. And then Built to Spill. I mean, maybe.
Well, Beck would have been right starting to pop off around then, too.
Exactly. Absolutely. And then Elliot Smith. Yeah. That was huge. And then Elliot Smith. And we're in high school, and we discover this other world. This is not mainstream. This is way, way, way before, like, Elliot was in
Good Will Hunting, yeah.
Which was like, whoa, what's going on here? I think the biggest thing to having my heroes exposed to the world, and of course, when you're a kid, it's horrifying.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want anyone to know what the cool stuff you know about. Was like the Volkswagen commercial with Nick Drake in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was amazing, of course, because it had turned on so many people. It exposed so many people to Nick. It was amazing. But
and that also was significant, I feel like, because it was one of the first times, along with a Carnival Cruise ad that used Lust for Life around the same time.
Wow, smart.
That, yeah, right? People were like, it's about heroin, where the song in the commercial was a significant, where it was something that people talked about, that song was in the commercial.
Mm-hmm.
That Volkswagen commercial was like a major moment like that, where it's like, oh, the right song that's an existing published song that's not like a jingle could be the cinematic version of a commercial. And it is, yeah, if you were, I'm sure for anyone who fell in love with Nick Drake's music before that commercial existed, it was, you know, a painful experience in a way now that feels immature to have cared about it. Now it's just like, man, I wish we could go back to a time when that was something to be fucking butthurt about, right? I mean,
I know. What a simple time.
And also, I guess it's just the thing. I mean, I'm the same, you know, I'm obviously like, indie, like, snob or whatever, technically. But
yeah, just snob, where it's fine too.
Yeah. Just snob, cut off the indie part.
Mainstream snob.
Well, you know, but the idea that, like, well, for folks who, it would not have been possible for them to have heard that song until they heard it in that commercial. And then they went and did the same thing that you did when you accidentally also got the Nick Drake, when it accidentally reached you as well. You know,
but at
same,
that
you
age,
get to the, you
at
get
that
there
age,
the same.
It's yours, and no,
oh, that,
else
of course,
can have it.
No, and I still, and I still, and I still feel that way about.
What do you feel that way about?
About, I mean, I still feel that way about the, my favorite music is all, always still going to be stuff that, like, it would annoy me if it got too popular, because,
yeah,
part of the reason I like it so much is that it's like not built for that or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, it's true. Maybe it
part of what you like about in the first place is something that's a barrier, that should be a barrier for other people, but that isn't for you. You know,
that's so true. That's something to yeah. It's just there. That was a really weird thing when I started seeing, because at that time, you're so self-conscious and you're so attached to finally having your own identity that when it gets threatened, it can really, throw you for a loop. And for me, it was when I started seeing jocks at Modest Mouse concerts. Like, it was the kiss of death to wear cargo pants. Pants are just the meant, and like whatever, some kind of sport related kind of hat and cargo pants. To me, those are the people that would, that I hated and hated me in high school.
Yeah.
And suddenly to see them at Modest Mouse shows, I remember that feeling of like, what a blow. I took it so personally. I was like, how could they do this to me? I'm like, it's absurd. It's insane. But it's so funny. I hadn't thought about that, how it felt at that time. What an absurd thing. How silly. But anyways, about the Elliot thing, I remember we're in high school. It's a group of like five or six of us. We love Elliot Smith so much. And we hear that when it says at Largo, John Bryan is playing, John Bryan and guests, sometimes that means Elliot. And we snuck into Largo at a John Bryan show, and sure enough, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to have a buddy of mine just play a couple of tunes, and it was Elliot, and Elliot's there, and I saw Elliot Smith play two songs. That was like one of the most beautiful, unbelievable moments of my life, and I, even while I'm watching, I'm like, whoa, I cannot believe it. Of course, I couldn't believe it was happening. It was mind-blowing, but then it's like, that's my Jimi Hendrix moment of being able to say, like, I saw Elliot Smith play, and in fact, it's really heartbreaking because it brings me back to a songwriter who passed away today. Daniel Johnston passed away today.
Yeah.
And that's somebody who, anybody who got to meet Daniel Johnston or see play or has any of his art or got to, just be around, it's such a finite amount of people on this planet now. They could say that they've experienced that.
Did you ever see him play?
I saw him play. Never got to meet him. But, was a fan since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Really one of the great songwriters, truly one of the great songwriters. And I think definitely, celebrated by the people in the know, but I still think there's a lot of people that would love his music so much if they heard it. So this is one of the...
Yeah, if this is the first time you're hearing that name, get in there. Like compared to a lot of artists that I've met who have an audience as large as your audience is, you're sort of in a category unto yourself as someone who never seems to have really strived for commercial acceptance. You've gotten a much larger degree of commercial acceptance than you've ever seemed to strive for. And I don't think striving for commercial acceptance is a bad thing. I think like a lot of artists reach a point where they're like, wait, it's possible to get more people to listen to my songs? Cool, I'll do a couple of things I didn't do before. But even in the examples of music you heard as a kid that you're talking about, it sounds like your path has been sort of free of worrying what else other artists were doing or what might be a template for a career for you. I mean, does that sound like you? Or, has there ever been a moment where you were just, where you were thinking like, I want to have a career at this?
No, not at all. It just seemed like if I don't have anything to hide behind, like starting out, there wasn't a band, there wasn't even a concept where I could kind of, I wasn't trying to put on a show or really entertain. You're really just trying to like go into this kind of use your vulnerability as a form of strength kind of place. And a lot of the beginning of half the set was a cappella, just because that seemed like, okay, let's just push how frightened I am of these things. This seems really scary, let's do that. But also laziness, like I was too lazy to like find other people to play music with or be like, let's put on a type of maybe multimedia show or something like that, which are wonderful things and are amazing, and later I had a band and the whole thing. But maybe this feeling that if you're not, that it seems exhausting to make up a persona, or it seems it seems exhausting to make up a I guess to not just be yourself. it's maybe born out of laziness. It's like really focus on just being yourself. But I'm really, I was fortunate that my friends in high school had, you know, unorthodox taste and were interested in things that maybe weren't getting any radio, or were definitely not getting any radio, or at that time, I guess that's about it, radio exposures. It's kind of this more indie world stuff, which was very valuable at the time. It was very difficult to find. It wasn't a genre on its own.
Right.
And my father had these world taste interests. That's why he got the David Byrne compilation and the Ali Farka Touré and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. It's kind of world music, music from different parts of the world that I'd never heard. Now, you definitely aren't getting exposed to just walking down the street. So that starts to expand the world to me. And I felt like they're all doing their own very different things. You don't have to, you know, that it seems like they're doing their thing. And that's all I'm going to do mine. And I'd read enough biographies that I knew that it's just got to be rough at the beginning. I know there's going to be rejection. I know that it's going to be, you know, door after door slammed in my face, because that's like how the cliche story goes. But that was good. It prepared me for that. And I went to, in college, I took a sound class, and the big portion of that class was about John Cage. And there's a quote of his, which is, "I have nothing to say and I'm saying it." And of course, he's literally maybe talking about a piece of music where there is
silence.
Silence, the very infamous piece. Is it 444, 442? I don't know. But it's 4 minutes and maybe 42 seconds. We'll have to look it up, 41 or 42 seconds of silence. Well, it's not really, and that's the point. You realize there is no such thing as silence. There's no such a thing. Even if you're in a, you know, sensory deprivation chamber or some totally soundproof space, you'll hear your own circulatory system. So there's no such thing as silence. And of course, it's an incredible piece because it hadn't been done before. It's so revolutionary, so highly conceptual. But also, it is the realization that there's no such thing as silence, and it's a piece that's being created in that moment. It's true improvisation. Somebody sniffing. They're, you know, sniffling, somebody shifting in their seat, somebody kind of, I guess today, getting a phone call, whatever, all these things are happening in the moment. It's so exciting. It's a totally collaborative piece at the same time. But the line, "I have nothing to say and I'm saying it," gave me so much freedom, because you're so worried when you're starting out as an artist. Like, I need to have something to say. I need to contribute to society. I need to, like, really, you're so frightened of not presenting something original or having your own voice or needing to find your own voice or what does that even mean? And, you know, there's a million kind of obstacles in the way of finally just letting go and accepting things as they are. And for me, it was this tremendously liberating moment. I have nothing to say and I'm saying it. Oh, okay. It kind of gave me permission to just do this thing because I enjoy it and because I love it. Do you play an instrument?
I do. I can play a little bit of piano.
Do you have a piano here?
I don't.
Oh, anyway, so when did I start?
When did singing start to feel good and like something that there's a satisfying endeavor?
It was putting on my mother's dress. No one was home. She was getting her things out. She was going to get ready, and she had her dress out on her bed. And she left to go to the whatever she went to go to. I don't know. But I was home alone. And the dress was on the bed. And it was just impulsive. It was this weird little lightning impulse, and I just put it on. And I just kind of combed my hair to the side. And I was just like, ooh, na, 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 la, ooh. And I was like, oh, whoa. It just felt like suddenly, you know, you want to draw, and suddenly somebody puts, you know, a brush filled with paint in your hand, and you can just like, wow, suddenly this bridge had been built. Oh, now I can sing. Really kind of unlocked something in me. And holy shit. It's probably going to look weird when she gets here. Better take it off. And like it changed. And it felt like my... something had been unlocked.
Mm.
And from then I really loved singing. Really loved singing. But I had no interest in really sharing that with anyone. It felt like I'd unlocked something inside of me, a type of energy or a space. And singing I could sing now from that place. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that I wanted to sing around people or in front of people.
Right.
And then, you know, music and playing an instrument and singing always felt like the platform for words. Like words is really where it's at, and that's where I feel like I have to work, okay, leave me alone, I have to work. It's not me really playing an instrument or singing. It's me writing, and I write every day. Every single day.
Is the melodic part, the vocal melody part, the singing part, is that where it starts?
It starts with the words, and then it becomes, okay, now let's find some music to clothe the words in.
Right.
What's going to best reflect these words? And in the right before we met, I moved to San Francisco because I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, and I was going for interdisciplinary, interdisciplinary course. We're doing sculpture, some performance, sound, poetry, painting, and drawing. And then new genres, which was very mysterious to me, and it still is. It was too much, too conceptual.
New genres.
New genres was its own thing. Oh, sorry. Yeah,
That we lost the
We lost
the unshadable sliver
of life.
Still some Diet Coke left, though.
That's even better. So this is the line. Okay. It's your line, and it's fabulous. First line. I'd read the rest of this book. We lost the unshadable sliver of light, but there's still some Diet Coke left. That could end the book.
Maybe it'll start and it's a reprise.
That's so good. How many books start and end with the same line? I'm sure a lot, but I can't think of one immediately.
Not very well read.
I guess the Bible, but that's the only book I've ever read. So
does the Bible start and end with the same lines? I've never read the Bible. Am I going to lose podcast subscribers because I've never read the Bible?
Well, I thought this was...
Mad subscribers is dropping off right now. That chick's never read the Bible. Mm.
I've never read the Bible either. Mm. But there's lines that I really like, actually. There really are. Man... that line, I love that.
Man...
When Jesus was like,
dot,
man...
Dot, 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 dot.
Son.
Son.
Man, son. Okay, wait. What the fuck were we saying?
We're talking about singing.
Oh, yeah, singing. And you sing Common People.
I
Common
sing.
Era. Bringing it back to them.
Bringing it back to them.
So, yeah, I sing now. I make music now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I have a guitar. I still play the guitar. It's crazy how little I play music with other people, especially since all my friends are musicians. We have many, many common friends.
Indeed.
Common people.
Common people. We have many common people in common.
Oh, so around the time that right before we met, yes. I went to San Francisco and San Francisco Art Institute. Interdisciplinary arts. But I'm going home after classes to play guitar. And at some club, I met someone named Joanna Newsom. And then they're like, this is my partner, Noah Georgeson. And then, this is my friend, Lucky Remington. And this is my friend. This is my brother, Pete Newsom. And this is, hey, we're all friends. You guys are cool. Let's go to this bookstore. Walk into this bookstore. And, who's the guy working there? Didn't you used to be in a band called the Raymond Break in North Carolina? Yeah, my name's Andy Kavik. But I'm starting a band now. I don't know. What do you think, Vetiver? And this all happened around the same... Exactly around
the
same time.
That's what everyone said, by the way, literally.
And that was...
I'm Andy Kavik.
That's how he talks. Yeah. He still says it to me. I'm like, I know you're in Vetiver. Every time. Hi, I'm Andy Kavik. I'm in Vetiver. I know, Andy. And so Noah is going to Mills for composition, and Joanna's going to Mills too, I believe. And both of them are true musicians who actually know how to write music, know how to read music, know how to compose and record music. And I'm like so in awe and so amazed and so excited to make these new friends who play music. And I asked Noah if he'd lend me some recording equipment. He said, sure, here's this 4-track, but the condition is I want to hear what you do. I want to get a copy of the cassette. So it was this challenge. And also it kind of forbade me from keeping it to myself. Mm. Might have been a good thing, but I always from the beginning had this intention of sharing it, and just thanks to Noah saying that. And then I moved to New York because the cassette gets, I play with Flux and Information Sciences, and their drummer at the time was Michael Girard's partner. I was obsessed actually with the Angels of Light. I kind of went backwards. Angels of Light, they had just put out How I Loved You, I think. A beautiful record with a song called Evangeline, which to me was like the best song I'd ever heard. And then I kind of went backwards and I really got into Swans. And I really lost my shit when I found out that Swans had covered Nick Drake's song. Mm. Swans covered Black Eyed Dog. And then I just knew. And actually today, it was a real challenge having to pick songs you'd wish you'd written. I chose Joan Armatrading's Willow. Mm-hmm. But at the top of the runner-up was Blind by Swans, which is a perfect song. But anyways, I moved to New York because finally somebody writes back. I've written to so many labels. Nobody gives a shit. I remember. And some of the labels are still active. Just rejection letters. No respond, no reply, fine. But finally one does. And he didn't say, I want to put out your record. He just said, hey, thanks for the cassette. And that was just enough for me to go, like, okay, I have to really do this. And my one friend had moved to New York. I move, and he's like, this is guy Adam Green. He's in the Moldy Peaches. They're really good. And they're really a great band. You should check them out. And they're playing with the Strokes. And Strokes at this time are literally the coolest band that has ever existed. So that even that, like, proximity was, like, very enticing and amazing. And I loved them, even when the Strokes came out. Except I was pissed off, too, because I used to wear a tie and, you know, my little, like, little jacket. And suddenly, you know, this is weird kind of ego thing when you're a kid.
Yeah. You're like, I have curly hair. Whatever, guys.
Nick Drake Volkswagen commercial thing where, like, that's my thing. And then you're walking down the street and someone's like, oh, you like the Strokes? I'd be like, what? No, I like the Velvet Underground. I'm, like, trying to rip off Lou Reed here. What are you, you know? But anyways, it's this kind of, like, everyone's neighbors in a weird way.
So you have a record coming out on Friday, which we would be loath not to at least mention.
Yeah, okay.
But also, I'm curious because although this won't come out for a few weeks, we are only 2 days away from you having a full-length album, your 10th studio album, I believe.
Sure.
Do you tend to feel excited, a sense of joyful anticipation when you have an album coming out? Are you feeling the 48 hours till my album comes out vibes or what? How do you feel, Dev?
I'm a little melancholy, a little blue. Not before a record comes out, but maybe that even does contribute to it, because you kind of work so hard on this thing, and then it's just already. Then that's it, you know, in a way. So maybe there's that weird kind of feeling. It doesn't. Nothing actually happens when you put the record out.
Right.
But I am excited to share it, of course. But I think the melancholy comes more from. Well, the fact that Daniel Johnston died today is definitely breaking my heart. And the fact that it's also September 11th. It's the anniversary of September 11th. And I actually went down with Christian, who I work with as my manager. We went down to World Trade Center.
The Ground Zero,
Ground Zero. And actually, they wouldn't let us into the monument because at that moment, it's just for family. Mm. And that just fucked me up. I just started crying. So thinking about, like, you know, the suffering that family members are, you know, still have to live with, and thinking about losing your parents, or in the flight, or your husband, or your wife, your child. Oh my God, so much suffering, so painful. So today is a good day to practice Tonglen, which is a Tibetan word for sending and receiving. It's kind of the only thing you can do. It's kind of the only empowering thing you can do when you're faced with so much suffering, which is to breathe in all the confusion, the suffering, the pain, the sorrow, and then breathe out peace and love and wisdom, healing to an individual or group of people or the whole planet, to yourself. But it's kind of one of the only empowering kind of things that I can do on a day that's so heavy, so sad. So it's a melancholy day. And I'm also sad because I'm a fan of you and your podcast, and I fucking blew it.
No, come on! This has been great!
It hasn't. It's been terrible.
Stop it, Devendra. It's been wonderful.
But you know,
this is what it's like for us to hang out.
It is what it's like. It kind of is.
That's what it's like for us to hang out. I love it. This is why we're pals.
The worst high five of all time. Concluded.
Devendra is just in the early days of a North American tour that has shows through the beginning of December, and then he's traveling around the world on tour next year. Check DevendraBanhart.com. I'm Jenny LSQ. I don't think I said that yet in episode 35 of the LSQ podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Up next, a conversation with David Cross about comedy and music and his taste in both. And I was fascinated to learn more about David's creative process as a stand-up comic, because he is in the early days of a new show that will likely end up becoming a tour and an album in 2020. Let's listen.
I was interested, we were emailing about, you know, meeting up to do this, and you're playing a bunch of shows. Playing, I say, as I describe a gig. You're playing a bunch of gigs coming up, and I asked, you know, might I stop by, and you explained that it was still early enough in this run of shows that it's too soon. And I'm just immediately fascinated by the thought of the difference between a rock show or a musician's gigs and the way a comic's gigs work, and the idea of like kind of jamming out, you know, for as analogy might go, jamming out your material for an audience as a way of like coming up with the song that very well may end up on an album that you release at some point.
Sure. It's very different because the physics of it, music doesn't really have a lot of silences, and the silences will tell me, will give me feedback, because I'm just talking. It's one guy with a mic, and just to explain these early shows, I don't really have material yet. I have some kind of kernels of ideas, little scraps of paper, ideas I write down. I bring sheets of paper up, and I'll go and print stuff out, and then things will occur to me either while I'm talking or a special guest has said something that spurs memory or makes me think of something, and I'll riff off that. But and talking to the audience, it's very, very raw. Sounds dangerous. I don't mean raw in that sense. I mean raw as in you just got a big pile of ingredients on the table, but they're not anything yet.
Yeah.
You know? And so the first, I would say, 7 shows are probably about as loose a comedy show as you might see, because anything that I've got worked out, I'm not doing right now. I'll bring that out when we get to phase 2. There's basically 3 phases to this process. And also I should say that this is a fairly new process for me. I did it the last tour to accrue material for the last tour. And it's such a fun thing to do, also because it's so loose, and there's such lowered expectations. I don't feel like an obligation to go kill, you know. It's like everybody understands what they're getting into, and I explain it up front. It's also in the kind of advertisement, but it's just if I have something kind of that's clicking that works, I just set it aside. This is all about working out new stuff, and there are several ideas I have that I'll do it twice, maybe 3 times. I go, that's not working, and then I'll ask the audience questions too, like, should I keep working on that? And then, like last night, I found a completely different angle on something that just I thought was a really good thing to explore, which is why we put so much stock in strangers' recommendations, like waiters and waitresses and people we don't know who say, oh, get that dish, go to this restaurant, eat that, and people we don't know, you know, friend of a friend of a friend or something, and especially like a waiter or waitress, and I was like, well, I don't know a thing about you. Right. I don't, you know. Right. And I'd done it a couple times, and it was okay. It just wasn't really clicking, and it, and I tried different angles, you know. And then last night, I was kind of doing a little Q&A at the end of the show, and somebody mentioned being a waiter, and a woman in the front said, oh, I was a waitress, and I used to think, like, why are you asking me? And then I was like, wait, that's how I should do it. I should do it from the other side, not right. me, but as the waiter answering that question. And then, you know, the audience was like, yeah, that's a good idea, you know. And so it's really good for that kind of stuff, because yeah. I cannot sit down and write jokes to save my life. I'm not a good joke writer. My brain doesn't work that way. On stage, stuff occurs to me, and I tape everything and then transcribe it and go, well, there's a kernel of something. Anyway, that is to say that these first several shows, that's what I'm doing.
Right.
So that's why I said, there's nothing to right. come to yet.
Yeah, but that's...
Like, diehard fans who are... Yeah. That's totally cool, and everybody has a good time, but... I personally, for people I know, I'd say, you know what, when I move to Littlefield or the Bell House and these shows start kind of getting a little bit more refined and taking shape, yeah, come down to one of those. You know?
Do you find that still that the kernel of, if you think there's something here, this is funny, there's something here that your instinct about that is usually true, that if you can work on it, that there's the things that seem funny to you immediately, like... In the way that a catchy song feels catchy immediately to an artist?
I would say almost 100% of the time it's true, but only 50% of the time or less am I able to make it work. Mm. So I think there's some funny ideas I've had that I just haven't figured out how to work that I could go give to a number of other comics and, like, you know, Patton Oswalt or Sarah Silverman could make this work, or, you know, Paul F. Tompkins or whoever.
Right.
You know, they can make this work. I just could not figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great things about hanging with other comics is sometimes somebody will have, you're so inside your own head, and somebody will have the clearest idea that's just, sometimes it is literally changing a word. It's changing the tense of something. It's changing, it's inverting yeah. something. It's something that simple. Not all the time, but occasionally somebody says, why don't you try to say this instead of that? And it just, all of a sudden, it's killing. And that's pretty cool, you know.
So was stand-up what you always, you know, when you were a kid first discovering your love for comedy, was picturing yourself on stage doing stand-up kind of the form it took?
Yeah, like, yes. I don't think I... It was a little less tangible than... It was easier to vaguely think of myself, like, I'm going to direct films one day. And mm-hmm. that's just sort of... I don't know what that looks like, so you just sort of think about it when you're right. 10 years old, 11 years old, 12, 13. And stand-up is... stand-up was a lot different, you know, when I was a kid. But I was way into comedy, and I was way into sketch, oddly enough, between like Python and Saturday Night Live, and then when I was a little older, SCTV. But I mean, the first gig I did was, I was 17, so.
That's young to be like, yeah, I'm going to try stand-up now.
Yeah, and to be fair, it was right before my 18th birthday, but I was still... Technically, yeah. I was 17. And,
so where was that stage?
The Punchline in Sandy Springs, Georgia, a suburb of Atlanta. Now it's all one big thing, but in Atlanta where I grew up. And I would go do open mic nights, and I did. Then there was a place called the Comedy Spot on Roswell Road. And
did you like it, though, immediately, or feel
Well, I had
natural?
The craziest experience that I would not recommend to anybody. And I'm going to describe it to you, and I'm not exaggerating. I'm not being hyperbolic. I'll tell you exactly how the evening went. But it was – so my first time, and I had one or two friends there that were friends who, you know, we all liked comedy in various forms. And I can't remember the guy's name, but there was a guy from New York City who was performing that week, and they'd make some extra money by hanging out on Mondays and Tuesdays. The week is usually Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You know, two shows Friday, maybe three shows Saturday, one show Sunday, and then you have the open mic nights. And they, you know, would stick around and make an extra of whatever, $150 and host. And this guy was a Catch a Rising Star guy up here, and I went up, and it took me years to find my voice, and I was heavily, to a fault, influenced by Andy Kaufman, Steve Martin, and kind of like absurdist stuff. And I went up with whatever my 5 minutes were, and I am killing. And it's the first time I've ever told my jokes in a room full of strangers, spotlight, brick wall behind me. And it's comical. I'm killing. And the little red light comes on, and I said, well, the red light's on, I gotta go. And people literally like, no, and like, stay, you know, whatever they were yelling out. And then I left. I had no more joke. I didn't, you know, I gotta go. And I left. And the comic, I wish I could remember his name. I can describe him physically. He was like, well, that was David Cross. That was, you know, something to the effect that kid's going somewhere. That was great, whatever. And I walked off that stage thinking, I'm great. I'm a great comic. Oh, my God. I mean, I'm telling you, it was comic. If you put it in a movie, you'd go like, this is
triumphant.
Too much.
Triumphant.
This is too much.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. And I, you know, signed up for more spots. And I would say the next 25 times I went on stage, I ate it. As I should have. There was no reason. There's no rhyme or reason why I did so. I cannot tell you what the weird kismet was, but and of course I was perplexed and
same
thrown.
Material.
Same material. Same exact material. Said the same way and saying things like, "Oh, I killed last week," you know, and that's the point where, you know, the feedback happens in the movies where the guy's bombing.
Oh my God! How had you been rehearsing those 5 minutes a lot before that first?
I don't remember rehearsing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I did in my room, but I don't.
And then, I'm guessing that a la playing music live, that, you know, I know when I go see a young artist early days and you're just like, okay, they need 100 more shows, but, you know, but in 100 shows, that's going to be really good or whatever, you know.
Sometimes it's about attitude too. You can just attitude pokes through, and you can see that as a positive, you know.
Yeah, you can see the magical magical sparkle. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that much that the first show, though, there's so much energy driving toward that first set. There's something just truly just like,
I don't know anybody
kinetic
that's
about.
Had that experience though. It was bizarre. It was so bizarre, and really threw me. You know, after that, I was like, what's wrong with me? What did I do? What am I doing differently? And there's no answer to it. You know, it's just, and then your confidence just drains, you know?
Right. But now I'm guessing you don't, a less good show doesn't throw you for a loop as much. You're just like, fuck it. It's a show.
I mean, I don't like it. I wouldn't say that it throws me. I'm at the point now where I just go, I do my best, and I haven't like tanked a show in, you know, decades and decades. I've never tried to purposely. I mean, when I was much younger, maybe, but I try to deliver. There are people that I have this thing. I know it's corny, but when I'm having that bad show, and of course, bad is relative. Bad to me might not be bad to somebody else, but it's bad to me. I will always think, or always be aware of that up in that balcony, I can't see them, but there's some kid, there's like a 17, 18 year old boy or girl that's up there that loves stand up, that is thrilled that stand up is coming to their smaller town, and they're so excited and they've saved up their money and they, you know, and this is their first comedy show, and I kind of do it for them, that imagined person in the back of the theater on the balcony, you know, who that was me, you know, that was me too. So I always try to kind of deliver with that idea in mind. And then have fun, you know, try to still have fun, you know. They're not all going to be like killer shows.
You mentioned some of the comics who influenced you early on, and I wonder if some of your early favorite music, if sort of your favorite comics and your favorite music artists seem cut from the same cloth to you. Are there similarities between your all-time favorite comics and your all-time favorite artists?
Yeah, I suppose so. There's kind of a punk ethos, I think, to my favorite comics growing up were, as far as like stand-up, was Andy Kaufman, Steve Martin, Stephen Wright, Lenny Bruce, Jonathan Winters, Richard Pryor, going off of whose albums I had, Franklin Ajay, Cheech and Chong, and of course Python. I had all their albums, but like, and you know, some of my, when I was really starting to be educated with music, and when that kind of punk new wave stuff was starting to come out, when I was coming of age, and, you know, X and Elvis Costello and The Clash and The Jam and, you know, Bow Wow Wow and,
yeah.
And you know, all the stuff from that era, Gang of Four and,
yeah.
And then as I got a little older, and then the kind of REM and Replacements,
right,
and all that kind of stuff. So I think there's a shared sensibility, and a lot of my favorite comics were my peers after a while, and I was very lucky and came up in comedy in a very creative, extremely creative environment and era, and when comedy was changing too, and we were all subtly adding our changes to it to make a different kind of stand-up. You know, I was heavily influenced by my peers, you know, and just some great, 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 great comic minds, you know.
And so what was the first music that really kind of told you that you were, you know, what was the first music you became obsessed with in
the
a
Who.
Way that felt different the from Who. Other kids?
It was
right.
The Who, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, I can answer that easily.
You had a couple of their records.
Yeah, I got Pinball Wizard as a single, and I think that was a gift, or I traded for it or something. And I remember my mom and dad, and this is when my dad was still around, so this I would have been about, I want to say, 9. And we were in Roswell, and they had gone to the theater, and they came back and they told me, oh, there's this, we saw a trailer for a movie that you're going to love. And I don't remember myself or anything I was interested in enough at the time to understand why they made that connection, but obviously they did. It was a trailer for Tommy. And they're like, you are going to love this. It's got that song you like or whatever. And and I don't know if my mom took me to see it when it came out or how I ended up seeing it. But, I mean, it blew me away. You know, it was like the trippiest, coolest thing. And I loved The Who for that stuff initially. Then, as I got older, I remember buying saving up my money and buying The Who by Numbers when that came out. So what was that, 75, something
yeah.
like that? So I remember that.
Weird era of The Who, but I love that record.
Not the best. But I was like deeply in like, and I must have been 9, 10, and you're like, this is my band. 11 years old, I don't know what I was, but I'm like, this is my band. And I got in trouble for spray painting The Who #1 and putting it in the cement and wet cement and stuff like that. And then when I got older and, you know, their early stuff, which was very kind of snotty and punky, I loved. And especially when I was getting older and meeting, you know, people who were also into music who were like, they liked prog rock and these guys liked the Beatles. I'm like, this song kicks that song. You know, that song's bullshit. Listen to how awesome, you know, it was a lot about attitude, too. And then when I got into Quadrophenia, that was it. I was done, and that was, like, the greatest thing, and this is my life, and oh, my God. And I was also, I should, part of this is because I was a big Anglophile, and my dad is from England, from Leeds, and the whole family off the boat, and So I had that, and I was in Roswell, which I knew wasn't right. I'm not supposed to be in Roswell, Georgia. I knew that.
Hmm.
I'm supposed to be in New York. I'm supposed to be in London, you know.
Riding a moped.
Yeah, riding a GS scooter with my haircut neat. And that was also part of the allure. And then when the jam came in, it was like, oh, right. Man, you know. But early on, it was The Who. Yeah.
And then did you start, would you go see shows as a in high school or college?
They were already, I mean I'm not
The Who, I just mean generally. When did you,
oh,
were
yeah,
you
yeah.
into going to see, you know, punk shows in your, you
yeah,
know?
There was a club called 688 on 688 Spring Street in downtown, kind of mid, it's like midtown, but probably the single most important club thing, space. There was a place called The Bistro that I used to go to as well. It was down the street. But they were more like kind of, there was that whole college art pop type of, you know, early REM and mm-hmm. B-52s and Pylon. I saw a lot of Pylon shows and
nice.
The Now Explosion. And there was that kind of melding of the kind of gay music scene and then the kind of art college pop stuff and new wavy things and stuff that really didn't have an exact definition, but had its fingers in a lot of different little things. And there's a place called The Nightery. That's the first time I ever got paid to do stand-up, was opening up for some punk band thing. But it was like this gay club, but it wasn't gay. It was like, it was gay, but it wasn't like a dance club. It was just
right.
It was where like RuPaul played. And, a good friend of mine in high school was in a band called it was RuPaul and the U-Hauls with featuring Wee Wee Paul, and that was his band. And then a lot of it every kind of thing melded into the next thing.
Yeah, it sounds very interdisciplinary or something.
And it was fun. It was a fun, cool time. We used to do stuff on cable access. And this won't mean anything to anybody under 40, but cable access was kind of the YouTube of back then. You would get, you know, there would be 2, 3, 4 channels and you could just go and put on a show and
yeah.
you could get, it would be on TV. And,
yeah.
And there were some crazy, weirdo shows. And my friends, Robert Warren and Todd Butler, who's now passed, and those all guys in different bands, would do these show and or be part of these shows on these weird cable access shows, and it was all people from the music scene, and then there was you know, blended into comedy as well, and I had a fake ID back when it was pretty easy to fake an ID, where my sister's friend had a mini camera, I want to say, and then you would take a picture of the ID and you could just like alter it and then laminate that. And it was good enough to pass at like 688, because I was going there, I was underage. And I performed at 688 too, twice, opened up for bands. That was a thrill.
Yeah. And I mean, at that age, though, did it feel to you as part of your identity, kind of that it was important to have the music world stuff as that you had your feet in
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, it was more important than comedy was. Comedy was still sort of, you know, swimming around, floundering. I wasn't really a comedian. I wanted to do it. I did stand up, you know, I did open mic nights and I'd write some sketch things out. But it wasn't like I was not at the point where I'm like, I'm a stand up. I do stand up, you know, I was trying to, but a lot of my friends were in bands and, I mean, almost all of them really. And that's just what you did.
Yeah.
You know?
And
it was
but
great.
You didn't have an urge to play music yourself particularly.
I just don't have that.
Same. I mean,
I don't have it. I think if I was adept at that, or not adept, but if I did have that skill,
yeah.
I think I'd be pretty good at it. But I tried learning the banjo and it was really difficult. I tried drums and guitar and I just didn't have it.
So you're going to be doing this current show in the phases that you've described for the coming months.
I'll be doing it if nothing comes up. It's another great thing about doing this stuff is I can always just stop. I mean, I'll honor my commitment to dates that I booked, but unless I have to go out of town or, you know, out of the country to work, but.
Right.
But barring that, I can just keep working on material and just, you know, keep pocketing bits and figuring it out. And then, you know, if nothing happens, then I just keep doing it and I get a new hour, hour and a half together, and I eventually go on a tour. If something does pop up, I'm like, oh, you know, you need to be in Toronto for the winter and spring. I'm like, okay, and I've got all that stuff ready to go, and I'll just pick up where I left off.
Yeah,
it's just the best thing. And I also, again, I know it's corny, but I love doing stand-up. I love it. I love getting up on stage and all of these forms and doing it. It's a creative outlet. It makes it, it helps every part of me and my personal life and professional life and mentally. It's healthy and I am lucky enough to, you know, live in a place where I can just, I literally just bike to these gigs. I, you know, until the weather gets too fucked up, I just bike to Union Hall or bike to Littlefield or bike to Bell House.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I get home and, you know, my wife will get up with the kid in the morning if I've had a late night, and, you know, and then if not, I get up with her, and it's kind of a dream life, you know? And then if I do have to stop, then I'm stopping for ostensibly a good reason.
Right.
You know, I'll honor the, you know, the shows that I can honor, and then I hopefully I'm off doing a cool part or directing something or something like that. So
yeah, but it's exciting to know that for people who might go to one of these upcoming shows, that they are along for part of a creative process, that they get to see a creative process happening or be genuinely a part of that process, you know, of the final joke.
Yeah.
Your way toward the final joke. So unless something even more exciting happens in the coming months, 2020 is likely that we'll get a possibility of a new David Cross tour and album. In the short term, people will be hearing this long before then and are encouraged, if they visit New York City,
progress. Or check out my website. It'll have all the info on it. And the first 10 to, I don't know, 12 shows will be very rough at Union Hall, where I'm just accruing
the bootleg sessions, as they're
bootleg
known.
Bootleg sessions. no recording, please. And then you start going, all right, I think here's all my material. I think it, you know, I think this would be a chunk. And then you do that chunk, and then you have a special guest, and I think this chunk works. And maybe, you know, and you have maybe 5 or 6 of those shows, and you go, nope, I was wrong. I shouldn't do the thing about cooking next to the thing about the dog dying. You know, that was a bad idea. And then this will segue into this. And, you know, it's fun. It's cool. But I'm at the very beginning stages.
Thank you so much, David, for visiting me for this podcast interview.
Sure. My pleasure. A beautiful day to ride my bike over to Greenpoint.
All right, that's it for episode 35 of LSQ. Massive thanks again to Devendra Banhart and David Cross for their time and candor and enthusiasm. And in the next episode, an interview with Caroline Polachek, formerly of Chairlift. She has a solo album that is about to come out. Maybe by the time you're hearing this, it will have just come out. But regardless, I had an awesome chat with her that I'll be sharing with you in the next couple of weeks. And subscribe if you haven't done that yet. Also, remember, you can reach me with feedback and questions on Twitter @JennyLSQ. Thanks again for listening.